Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Jim Daniels. Jim Daniels' new book, Birthmarks, was published by Boa Editions in 2013. Other recent books include Trigger Man, More Tales of the Motor City, which is fiction, Having a Little Talk with Capital P Poetry, and All of the Above, all published in 2011. In 2010, he wrote and produced the independent film Mr. Pleasant. His poem Factory Love is displayed on the roof of a race car. A native of Detroit, Daniels teaches at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, where he lives in Oakland, near the boyhood homes of Dan Marino and Andy Warhol. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Hi, Jan. It's great to be here.
It's really good to have you. You know, you write so many books, which is kind of amazing, and so sometimes we miss some of the books along the way, but it's good to have you here to talk about Birthmarks, and congratulations on the new book.
Thanks. I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, it's really terrific. So why don't you just start?
Okay, I'll start with the title poem, Birthmarks. She was stymied by pizza, but not by ice cream. She ordered vanilla for its sound. She reigned as queen of the Isle of Eudicide. He had the patience of a splinter working its way to the surface and the business sense of a herd of cattle. She used her checkbook to prop up every minor purchase. He used cash for the benefit of its traceless disappearance. In short, he was a bad magician and she was the nervous assistant, a match manufactured in a damp swamp. Yet, they set off enough sparks to produce me out of a hat, dazed by their applause. Technically, I can't remember that far back, but I can make up a few things, given the lack of memory and receipts. And this poem is called Mega Everything. I've been teaching a long time, and so this is about one of my experiences teaching, where a student turned in a Black Sabbath lyrics as a poem. So the epigraph for the poem is part of what he turned in from War Pigs by Black Sabbath. Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death construction. Mega everything. The kid with stringy blonde hair and torn Megadeth t-shirt plagiarized song lyrics in his poem. Black Sabbath, I said. In my tiny gray office, he idly kicked the metal desk, not meeting my eyes, but then he never did. 1972, Michigan State Fairgrounds, Black Sabbath ripped through the sharp muffle of Paranoid on the distant stage while I guzzled malt liquor from quart bottles on a gloomy Saturday afternoon. Ozzy stalking on stage scared me in a familiar Detroit way, like a biker gang crashing a high school party. I shook it off. I raised my fist. He said turning in the lyrics was a test, but would go no further. Had I passed? Those lyrics, the only semi-coherent thing he'd turned in all term. He could have fooled me with Megadeth lyrics. Perhaps he had. We agreed that he should drop. He hesitated at the door like there might be one more thing. 16, my ears buzzed with dark star feedback, barking dogs, bloody teeth, fragments of a thorough ass-kicking. Ozzy's wire-cutter voice asked what happened when we died and where exactly was the soul. When the thunderstorm arced down on us, no one fled. We stood and took it. Poetry was all I had that wasn't toxic. I should have been easier on the kid. His name was Chris. He slumped away, black boots clomping against the floor, and I never saw him again. The bitter mascara of the unrepentant and the flawed jewel of self-absorption. Ozzy's damaged now beyond coherence. He hadn't yet bitten the head off a bat when I saw him in 72. He only had to do it once. The rest of us, Chris, we think about it every day under the black, incoherent moon. This poem is called One Word, about a motorcycle accident my brother was in. My brother lies in his hospital bed, steeped in the clammy smell of the almost dead. Stitches hang stiff under his chin, a scraggly Fu Manchu they sewed on him, fresh off life flight, his motorcycle mangled by a 16-year-old running a stop sign. My brother is simply trying to speak, to push out a single word. The breathing tube's been removed. We thought when it came out, he'd be telling us he's going to be all right, or at least where it hurts, but his brain still spun, weaving a fuzzy web. We were bent over, smelling the pain at his lips so close those stitches prick. He's making a noise something like the Tin Man, but he's not saying, oil me. He's not saying, what? Listen, come on, try again. It's more than a groan and less than satisfactory, like the slow-mo grunt of a tennis player so jazzed up he can't just hit it and keep quiet. Like the door to the principal's office swinging open for you. Come on, open your eyes, just one eye. A sound like grating breadcrumbs, an oral afterthought unfinished, the squeaky chair you squirm in, a dud firework. 6 days and they haven't given him a bath. He reeks. His thing's beeping again. And where's the nurse? And wait, we love you. Can you hear us? It's less than a whistle and more than maddening. The Tin Man's faux clumsy rattling dance. That dude's going to Oz, so why not us? We all have hearts. Brother, we'll make a deal with the damn witch. Trade her some of your neat handwriting and good manners, broomsticks, slippers, a package deal for a little translation, a little more wet space between dry lips for sound to slip out. Anything, anything. My eyes closed, concentrating on the subtle rise and fall of what are less than syllables, but more than random. Oh, my brother, we're lighting the torches and heading out into the darkness to find the words and bring them back to you.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Jim Daniels. He's reading from his new book entitled Birthmarks, published by BOA. Jim, you're really great at making stories come alive with detail. And, you know, like book after book, you've written a lot of books at this point, and yet there's more stories and more detail. Can you talk about your love of stories or what drives you to those details, you know? Your poems are full of them.
Well, I've always been a pretty narrative poet, but I like the compression and intensity of poetry, where you can just squeeze things down into this tight, compact little thing to give it that kind of intensity. And you know, once I start writing, I remember things that I didn't know I remembered. And like that in the opening poem, Birthmarks, what I don't remember, I just sort of make up. But it's in the kind of spirit of the memory, and I just have to kind of trust it to come out. That's why I can't write nonfiction, because I'm always making stuff up.
Yeah. I read something I sort of already knew, that your heart is in Detroit, that, you know, you're from Detroit. But I was wondering, you know, you've been in Pittsburgh a long time, and you write a lot of working class poems, which are amazingly great, but I'm wondering if you have any internal conflicts as a writer, writing poems of class, and I'm going into your real life here, but having been a university professor for many years and having, you know, not a working class job, and I'm asking you, when you write, is there any internal conflict that comes up as possibly seeing yourself as a working class poet?
Well, one of the things I've been consistently interested in as a writer is writing about the experience of work. And so in Birthmarks, I probably have as many poems about teaching as in any of the other books. So one of the things I'm really interested in, I'm certainly interested in social class and write about that, but in terms of drawing from my own experience, I think one of the fascinating things about work as a subject is it's often avoided in our literature, particularly our poetry, and it has so much effect on every other aspect of our daily lives. And teaching is another occupation that has that kind of effect. So I've been exploring that, but Detroit is, you know, in my heart, and I can't help but go back, and I don't really think consciously too much about it, because I think that can mess you up, particularly when there's a kind of political aspect to anyone's poems, as you know, where you don't want to be writing a kind of propaganda or idealizing things. But I continue to kind of go back and try and deal with the present as well. So I don't feel like I'm sort of taking on anything that I don't feel comfortable with as a writer, and I hope the reader feels that way too.
Yeah, I mean, they ring really true. And you know, I'm also thinking of your earlier series from years ago, the Tenure Guy poems.
Oh, right, yeah.
So you have been writing about the work of teaching for many years also. I wasn't responding as a reader, but more, I guess, thinking as a writer, how you get to those poems. But that, you know, you answered that, I think.
Yeah, I think it's just, well, that's home.
Yeah.
Even though I've been in Pittsburgh longer than I lived in Detroit, it's still, I mean, still have a lot of family there and friends, and it's my anchor, really.
Yeah. And I've been in Detroit when you're reading, and it's like, you know, Bruce Springsteen has entered the room, yeah. So they considered you home also, clearly.
Oh, I love reading there because it's a home game, but you know, I'm probably more nervous reading in Pittsburgh than in Detroit.
Really?
Yeah. Because there's more people from my present life.
Oh, okay.
There.
Yeah. I gotcha. Okay, can you read some more?
Sure. Actually, this is a more of a lyric poem. It's called On Tears. Tears do not add up with the firmness of American quarters, or pennies, or dimes. They fall with the urgency of escapees, no way to lose the dogs of grief who will lick them up, swallow, and stand firm, panting, waiting for more. Even Alice's pool of giant tears only measures 4 inches deep. What if we all met in mourning and shed our tears into a large hole and created a new Great Salt Lake? Well, if the moon were a wafer of bread in the salty pond, the broth of redemption, we might have something. But there's no saving the moon, somebody nibbling it away each month, or maybe the sky itself is the pool of tears, and the stars grains of salt, or okra in the soup. Tears fall and evaporate so quickly, nobody has time to lick or collect them, label and study them under microscopes for self-pity or self-righteousness. Even the drip from the faucet, bigger than one tear. Is there anything sadder than a tear emerging to weave down the landscape of the cheek, sometimes even down the neck, then another, if they don't fly off the chin? If you don't have somebody with a tissue saying, "There, there." Once you reach a certain age, nobody says, "There, there," ever again. Maybe that's sadder, the last "there." And you're on your own, spilling them into small droplets on the floor or the rug or the cement or the car seat or the gravestone. And you're swallowing hard, and they count for nothing. And this poem might make me feel like an old fogey, but it's making a case for the letter because, you know, very few people write letters anymore. I open the October envelope from Linden, Michigan, where my old friend Doug Johnson resides with his wife Marcy, who I hadn't seen in 20 years, though I did attend their wedding in December 1977 in Detroit, where I had a suspicious mustache and a shiny disco shirt purchased for the occasion, one too many buttons unbuttoned, and picked up a nurse friend of Marcy's, and we ended up in a car parked in her parents' driveway trying to have sex in December. Unsuccessful despite good intentions and slippery clothing. Yet I promised to call her before going back to college, but then my friend Jack called from Alma to tell me my autumn girlfriend, Ann Devine, had died in a car accident in Colorado, asleep in the back seat as her aunt drove, crashed. That fast, he said, to say something. And I rushed back to Alma early just to grieve with our common friends, and though we weren't sleeping together at the time, I may have been her last lover. She was kind to my dog and all living creatures, and I cannot tell you why we broke up since our last conversation was about borrowed records and Christmas plans, because, of course, we would see each other again in January, and who knows, maybe try again. When I open Doug's letter, a tiny yellow leaf falls onto my red kitchen table, because the leaf fell on the sheet of paper he was writing on, so he felt he should include it. And it made me think of that autumn in 1977, and Anne, beautiful with long blonde hair, 6'1 like me. So we saw eye to eye, touched hip to hip, and danced at the Bluegrass Festival in Remus, Michigan, held on some guy's farm, and made quiet love in the woods off the path in the middle of October sunshine, and held each other naked and warm on my old blue sleeping bag, and listened to the sweet whine of fiddles in the distance. And the world was spinning around our little circle of love, surrounded by tall trees, the wind gently dropping small yellow leaves on top of us, so that when she stood naked, her long blonde hair speckled with them, I thought for a moment to brush the leaves away, but then just lightly stroked her hair instead, leaves and all, and maybe I called her a goddess. Marcy said her friend understood why I didn't call back. In the car, after giving up, she and I had smiled and laughed at the odd contortions of our lust and how we did not know each other. Maybe we should just send each other envelopes of leaves, eh, old friend? I shaved off the stupid mustache and never had an occasion to wear that shirt again. Who knows the last time we're going to wear something? Oh, Anne, long, long gone, the leaves still falling.
If you just tune in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Jim Daniels, reading from his new book, Birthmarks. I'm noticing I think some new things in your work. You can tell me if I'm right here, but you know, just in the few that you've been reading here, the last thing something happens. I think more tougher stuff in this book. You know, maybe more death, more, and sometimes the voice I think gets more. I don't know, angry or cranky or something. which I think is really good. I mean, the voice seems less friendly to me in a good way.
Well, I guess when I was putting this manuscript together, I wanted to go cranky a little bit. I said, because I wanted to go kind of all in with that.
Uh-huh. Is that what you said to your editor? I'm going cranky with this. Well, it's working. I mean, can you say a little why?
Well, part of it is my age. I'm getting older, and I guess I have less time for dwelling on things and with a kind of fake nostalgia or anything like that. And I think when you write about the past, the idea of nostalgia or the threat of nostalgia is there in sort of a negative, self-indulgent way. So I kind of try and call myself on that, so I have that edge of, you know, not looking through the rose-colored glasses or any kind of glasses at all.
I mean, I don't think that was ever in your work, but there seems to be a shift here that's, I think, really strong. So can you read some more?
And maybe I'll talk about class a little in terms of this poem and...
Okay.
You know, what we were talking about before, because this is a family poem about all the different work experiences that particularly my brothers and other relatives have had, because I realized that we all have kind of stayed in one place for a long time, as opposed to moving around from job to job. And, you know, what does that say about us? So this is called Company Men. My grandfather worked at Packard's for 43 years. My father worked at Ford for 35. One brother worked at Big Boys for 20, then Chrysler for 15 and counting. Another has worked at GE for 35 and counting. The third has worked at Chevron for 30 and counting. I have worked at Carnegie Mellon for 32 and counting and counting. We do not look for new jobs. We take what they give us. We drink our coffee black. We tip the mailman at Christmas. We mow our lawns and prop up our houses, reluctant to call an electrician or plumber. We believe in fixing what's broke, not in cafeteria lines or IOUs. We pack our own lunches. We are proud of taking it without complaint. We believe in God's dance floor and the boogie-woogie of interest-bearing checking accounts. We accept wooden nickels and trim them into 5 toothpicks. We like toothpicks. If restaurant offers none, we are permanently suspicious. We fly our flags on holidays, but not bumper stickers. We do not believe in bumper stickers of any kind. We believe in turtle wax and in all things turtle because we are plodding in our hard shells toward the finish line. When Packard went belly up, my grandfather lost his pension. He lived off Social Security for 30 more years. He handed us dollar bills to his grandsons like tickets to the big game he wasn't able to go to himself due to prior commitments. And we took those dollar bills and saved them for rainy days, for it was always a sunny day when we got dollars from our grandfather. Nobody has a gold watch, but we will tell you the time. And if we are stupidly smug about our years of seniority, forgetting the lesson of our grandfather, forgive us. We are not squeaky wheels. We are silent even on each other's porches, analyzing mortar between bricks for signs of crumbling. Our companies moved us up, then stopped moving us up. And so we listen to the young bucks and nod as they tell us how to do our jobs. We do not discuss our jobs. We leave our jobs where they belong. Two of us laid off now, the counting suspended due to inclement weather or unreliable mathematicians, a wrong turn or global hijinks. We can't be sure, scraping our fingers against the mortar. The story says the tortoise beats the hare, but that's not what bank books say. We are never late, God willing, though we're not sure he is.
Nice poem.
Well, thank you. Yeah, for me, I do, I guess one of the things that continues to make me interested in social class is because it is often not as big a part of the national conversation politically, much less in poetry. And I feel that I want to talk about it and that we should be talking about it more, particularly as the middle class disappears and the gap between the rich and poor continues to get bigger. So I do have that, I guess, little chip on my shoulder, no matter how many years I've been teaching.
Right, right. I mean, it's been crazy to hear some of the conversation about the middle class struggling as if that's a new thing. And it seems to make the news because it's the middle class. And I'm like, well, what about the working class? Let's talk about that. But so I'm really grateful for your poems. I really am. And that's a great one. I mean, you have two other poems. I don't know if you'd be interested in reading either of them, Geography of Detroit or Feed Corn, or if you had something else in mind, go ahead.
Feed Corn's a little longer. So this is a poem that I have not heard from my sister about yet. But it's called Feed Corn. My brother, my friend Bill, and I left the factory simultaneously in an act of speed-laced bravado and drove east from Detroit in search of an ocean and a comfortable state of oblivion. But before we arrived, my brother fell off the car roof on a remote back road in New York State when I drove under the low-hanging branches of the rest of our lives. After we stole corn from a field and boiled into oblivion over our campfire, was still hard and inedible as crow, though crows and pigs would not have minded devouring it. Kumbaya, indeed. At the campground, we stole the underwear of two Canadian girls. Did we? Maybe we just grabbed them off their tent ropes because they hung drying, examined them, then tossed them like penalty flags. Maybe we just looked and giggled like boys. We were not undrunk, and my memory is biased on the side of 3D glasses and idealized soundtracks. Here, we take a big jump into my uncle's boat in Massachusetts. We drank us under the table, and since under the table was water, we swam to shore while he threatened to get us jobs we hate as much as he hated his. Maybe you got your feet wet on that jump. While you're wet, let's jump again to watch the sunrise with the sad school teacher camping on her own who had room in her tent for me. Camping by myself in a state park was added to my list of depressing things I vowed I'd never do. Oh, I've done them all. That's the short version. The long version is still being edited as I speak. I'm taking the dust off the needle, then poking myself in the eye with that needle, then falling into a haystack of needles, from which I will emerge with tattoos and humility. But that's years from this now. We drove home and back to work because the truth is that the layoff was temporary and we were called back. I could make a list of many people I would like to call me back, just as I am going out the door, just as I am getting in the car, just as I am getting on a bus, train, plane. I walked on a lot of eggs and broke every one of them, so I was lucky to get a wave or one of those little half-smile grimaces that suggested if I lingered one more minute, someone would scream at high decibels. Hearing protection required. Today, I'm wondering how much hearing I lost. Is there a finite amount of shame in each lifetime? We did not exchange phone numbers or addresses, and I forgot her name within 48 hours. She may have forgotten mine sooner. She pulled up her stakes. It's the only sunrise I've seen above the ocean. I think sunsets are supposed to be the bigger deal, though that's a lot further from Detroit as the crow flies or the dog dies or my uncle lies about his Navy days. Keep moving. I know that doesn't make much sense. Before I go, I want to tell you about Elvis dying. It's been in my head all along. I almost didn't want to mention it, given his cartoon nature. The fried peanut butter and banana sandwiches, the monkeys dying on the toilet. My sister loved Elvis. No wonder she ended up a Republican. Okay, cheap shot. I think all shots should be more expensive. We heard the news on one of the three stations left on the radio in my Plymouth satellite, the antenna removed in an unfortunate parking lot altercation. We called it our Options Limited World Tour. Very small world, I know, but shrinkage, etc. We knew our sister was bawling her eyes out back in Detroit and that her tears were genuine human tears, so we didn't even joke about it, though back home we teased her without mercy. I never knew what she saw in Elvis, but I imagined her inconsolable on her flowery bedspread in the tiny room she shared with my grandmother. I felt like an alien stone had landed in my chest, that weighted loss I had yet to feel since I'd believed in no one or nothing my entire life like that, not even God. It's no wonder that we accidentally ended up in Canada as we listened to the news. Love me tender, hound dog. Amen.
It's tricky writing about family. But you went for it there.
Yeah, I admit it was a cheap shot on my sister, but...
Oh, you think that's going to work? Okay.
We'll see.
But yeah, like I said, lots of risks in this book. And I love how that poem travels, like the people in the poem are traveling. We have time, I think, for more.
One thing I haven't read any poems about it is my children, and this poem's about my kids. It's called The Gravity of Math. My daughter counts how many people will love her forever. She says two, me and her mother. My son says three. Does that mean you love me? She asks. He's seven. She's six. The moon is nearly full. Dreams are silent. I'm counting how many slabs of gray stone I've leaned against. He admits it, buckled in back there, behind me. I can't see. The light pours loosely onto the pavement in front of us, spilling around the corner toward home. Feel my heart, she says. The world tilts. I lean in to the turn. And this is a love poem, probably the only kind of love poem I can write, called Love Poem with Pesticide. Morning frost on our side of the hill until sun angles down through the white flutter of the first blooming almond trees, now shining through here. I've been cupping your breast and singing off key. Now we stand half-dressed in the open field, a joyful shiver and squint. Above us on the hill, our neighbor wrestles his sprayer off the truck. Everything we have not risked, we've abandoned to be here together. He nods, we wave. The poison mist descends through the trees in an unapologetic, almost beautiful rainbow down on us. We linger.
The poetry of Jim Daniels, reading from his new book, Birthmarks. Thanks so much, Jim. It was great.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.